Welcome to Miller Kane, A True and Exact History, a serialized novel by Samuel Ligon, published for the first time in The Inlander and broadcast by Spokane Public Radio. Miller Kane is made possible by Sprint and The Inlander. Previously on Miller Kane, Miller and 8-year-old Carlene were visiting Laura Ingalls Wilder's house in Missouri of Little House on the Prairie fame when a shooter attacked a nearby elementary school. Miller has just learned the grim details. 498 dead, a record-breaking massacre. Miller is stunned, even though this used to be his way of life, traveling the country from one mass shooting to the next, comforting and also profiting from the victims. It was a calling he took up after his own brother, Charles, died trying to stop a school shooting. But now, Miller has Carlene, and they've been on the road all summer while Miller tries to keep her safe from her estranged father. Along the road, Miller had been passing the time writing biographies of famous Americans for a history textbook, each beginning with the question, hero or villain? But Miller's editor, George, recently fired him for wasting time on these wild stories. A warning to listeners, this episode is fictional, but it does deal with the subject of mass shootings and may not be appropriate for all listeners. Now, here's author Samuel Ligon.
Chapter 7, Part 8. Miller mined the news for details. One shooter, hundreds of victims, a truck bomb at the back of the building, grenades, IEDs, kerosene, thousands of rounds of ammunition. In the days ahead, the details would accumulate, updates and quotes, struggles to understand a killer who seemed like such a good guy, so clearly mentally ill, a stamp collector who hated his mother, his father, but loved guns and video games, everyone who knew him knowing something like this would happen, though no one could have guessed what or when. Victim bios would run for weeks, but the stories would finally fade, followed by bumps of interest and smaller, almost meaningless massacres. Then a killer would rack up 1,000 bodies, then 5,000. There had to be a limit for a single shooter massacre. We just hadn't reached it yet. Miller thought of his brother on the floor at Sunny Day, wrapped around his son, who'd killed 7 kids. Charles trying to stop him, to save him, the cops killing them both. What else were they supposed to do? All Miller could do was protect Carlene, which might be impossible, but he'd try. It seemed like days and months had passed since he'd sat in the coffee shop planning his next hero villain. He poured more whiskey and propped himself on his bed to write. Hero Villain 7, Laura Ingalls Wilder and Crazy Horse. They fell in love and got machine guns, taking everything they could get their hands on, whatever was left, robbing and killing and screwing everyone. They rode through the country on horseback and motorcycles, in fast cars and passenger trains, taking what they wanted and what they didn't want, taking everything, money and booze and people's lives if they got in the way, becoming heroes to the folks of Arkansas and Oklahoma and South Dakota and everywhere else. God, they were beautiful. They could never get enough of each other or anything else, but all around them, the rich got richer, taking more and more, while the rest of us fell into booze and heroin and impotent rage. It wasn't just that so few had everything, the money and judges and private islands. It was how they wouldn't stop crapping out literacy programs, hospital wings, shacks for the homeless, single-parent college funds, as if they expected to be thanked for their largesse, until Laura finally said, "We don't want your damn charity," holding a gator knife to a billionaire's throat. "What we want is what you have, all of it." And they took it, Laura and Crazy Horse, spreading it to the rest of us in the form of turkeys and guns and mortgage payments, but keeping most for themselves or burning it. They tracked down one philanthropist after another, cut his throat, took what he had, everything he'd claimed to work so hard for, then moved to the next one. Laura's family had never had anything except promises of a better future, and Crazy Horse had never had anything that wasn't taken away. Their solution was guns, more and bigger. And though massacres had never worked in the past, Laura and Crazy Horse used them to enforce an equitable distribution of wealth, a chicken in every pot, clean energy subsidies, eliminating the need for fossil fuels, the earth healing itself, disease eradicated, all based on a conjoining of Indian and pioneer superpowers. Finally, we could live up to the promise of our ideals. Everyone free and equal and happy and immortal. Laura and Crazy Horse spreading the goodness until everyone had everything. No one greedy or mean or hungry. At which point they beat their guns into plowshares and the era of massacres was over. Or this. Laura was a tiny woman married to a failed farmer, Almanzo, a.k.a. Farmer Boy. She called him Manly, and he called her Bessie, and their daughter Rose had a donkey they all called Spookendyke, which had nothing to do with Rose being a lesbian, if she even was one. There are times when all we can think about is who's a lesbian and who isn't, wondering why we all aren't. But this isn't one of those times. What matters here is Rose and Laura's complicated mother-daughter relationship, especially as Rose got older and became a successful writer and encouraged her mother to write, never once dreaming that Laura's success would overshadow her own, which it did, which wasn't fair because they wrote those damn books together. Rose reworking her mother's plots and prose, a secret that aided her until she became an acolyte of Ayn Rand, putting her own name only on books of unreadable propaganda, reserving her real revenge for her will, in which she left the copyrights of her mother's books to Roger McBride, an anti-government zealot and 1976 libertarian presidential nominee, Laura's lucrative mythology feeding his and the Koch brothers' causes for eternity. If only Crazy Horse had been around to cut somebody's throat. But Crazy Horse had died on an office floor at Fort Robinson 2 years before Laura's family moved to the shores of Silver Lake. Everyone wanted him dead. He'd become a symbol of resistance, of the old ways, and as a symbol, he was already dead but for the killing, as finally administered by William Gentles with a bayonet. It took hours for Crazy Horse to die on the floor of the adjutant's office where he refused a bed. Private Gentles, an Irishman, died a few months later of asthma. But that's not all. There's good here, too, mixed with bad, because Crazy Horse had a big bad love when he was young, with Black Buffalo Woman, who ran away with him, though she was married to No Water, who tracked them down and shot Crazy Horse in the face, which didn't kill him, but drove Black Buffalo Woman away. In a movie, this would explain everything. In real life, Laura and Manly were cursed or blessed with a tepid love. It was a miracle that she got pregnant at all. They moved from South Dakota to Missouri, Laura reflecting on the land in a diary, how she wished for an artist's hand or a poet's brain or even to be able to tell in good, plain prose how beautiful it was. If I had been the Indians, she wrote, I would have scalped more white folks before I ever would have left it. Later, Laura would scalp whoever she wanted, billionaires mostly, until Crazy Horse said, first of all, you were not the Indians. Second of all, we did not leave. We were forced off that land. No amount of scalping could have changed anything. To which Laura replied, I would have kept scalping anyway, implying that she loved the land more than Crazy Horse did, which infuriated him, his rage infuriating her, draining their love and any hope of killing the rest of the billionaires and saving the world, because all they wanted now was to kill each other. But you know what, George? Even if they couldn't save the world, even if we're all just killing ourselves and each other as the empire collapses, I still believe in this project and everything we can become. Now doesn't have to be our end, George. Consider the dawn of the Civil War when we've been coming undone for decades and finally began ripping each other to pieces. Consider the Great Depression and all the unnamed depressions when all we had to eat was our babies. Consider slavery and emancipation and Reconstruction because There was Reconstruction, George, even in the wake of the Klan's murderous tide. Consider Jim Crow, then the Civil Rights Act, triumphant and transformative, even as it fell apart piece by piece, but not all of it. Consider the long view, George, how things have gotten incrementally better. Hamilton and Burr shooting each other, yes, but everything swelling and resolving, becoming good, then horrible, then a little bit better. America, the beautiful, the massacre, immaculate, but not merely immaculate or a massacre, George, because I'm trying to show you the whole picture here, not just dirt and shine. There's love in that, George, in struggling to see ourselves, to know ourselves, even knowing that parts of us are awful. I don't think you see it that way, though, and you should. I'm not sure you see anything the way you should, George, certainly not me. Still, I am loath to close. We're not enemies, George, but friends. Though passion may have strained, it must not break our bonds of affection. The mystic chords of memory stretching from every battlefield and patriot grave to every living heart and hearthstone all over this land will yet swell the chorus of the Union when again touched by the better angels of our nature. And if I've succumbed to the worse angels of my nature, George, I'm a little drunk here, so I hope you'll forgive me. What I mostly want is to give us another chance, George, forgiveness for everyone. Maybe not everyone. Maybe not Charles Manson or Jim Jones or John Wayne Gacy or Bloody Bill Anderson or Lizzie Borden or Huck Finn's father. But forgiveness for most of us, George. Certainly for you and me, touched as we'll be by angels.
You've been listening to Miller Kane, A True and Exact History, a novel by Samuel Ligon, published in weekly installments by The Inlander, with archived audio at SpokanePublicRadio.org/MillerKane. Our theme music is by Indian Goat. I'm your producer, Chris Messini. Join us next week for the latest episode of Miller Kane.